Melbourne. It's Victoria's powerhouse, home to 5.3 million people, nearly a fifth of the entire country, which is impressive because the city's basically thriving while missing something huge. Any ideas what? Stick around and find out. And if you like these map drops, hit subscribe so I can finally upgrade from "Where's that?" to "Been there, still broke." Okay, Melbourne has bridges. Prince's Bridge downtown, the Bolt over the Yarra, but follow the river all the way to its mouth, and nothing. No grand span, no showpiece, just Port Phillip Bay, where Melbourne was founded back in 1835. Today, it's the busiest trade hub in Australia. It's packed with people and ships, all because of one simple thing: trade. Like Costco in urban form, minus the discount hot dogs. On the north rim of Port Phillip Bay sits the Port of Melbourne. It's the country's busiest. About 3 million shipping containers roll through here every year, enough steel boxes to build a Lego set the size of a small country. But here's the paradox. The port is so important that it doesn't have the one piece of infrastructure you'd expect. Other port cities would demand it. Melbourne just sit off and carries on. At the mouth of the bay, between the Mornington and Bellarine peninsulas, near Sorrento and Queenscliff, there's no bridge. Never has been. Why? Short answer, the ocean fights back. Long answer, give me 45 seconds. Point Nepean and Point Lonsdale are only about 2 miles, 3.2 kilometers apart. Close enough that you could almost swim it if you're in a hurry to meet your ancestors. But a bridge here wouldn't be that short. Why? Because this narrow stretch is one of the most treacherous waterways on Earth. Think less calm scenic bay, more mess up your entire life. This is the Rip. The only way it could get more Australian is if it was called Bruce. It's the border between Bass Strait and Port Phillip Bay. The waters in the triangle between Nepean, Lonsdale, and Shortlands Bluff makes the Bermuda Triangle look like a kiddie pool. Around 3,200 ships squeeze through here each year to reach the Port of Melbourne. The problem? The channel is much narrower than it looks, because, fun fact, solid rock doesn't politely end at the shoreline. It keeps going underwater. Who knew? Submerged reefs jut out from Nepean and Lonsdale, cutting down the space ships can actually use. The Rip looks wide, but really, there's only about 0.6 miles, a kilometer, of navigable water. It's like trying to thread a needle during an earthquake. Rookie captains? Forget it. Since 1840, at least 30 ships have tried and failed, now serving as full-sized aquarium decorations. But busy ship traffic in such a narrow passage is only part of the problem. Building a bridge across the Rip would mean taking on Mother Nature, and that's not a fair fight. There's an event called Rip Swim, which lets people pay money to do what shipwrecks already proved was a bad idea. It happens each summer, February down there, and in July, just to keep things chilly. Teams swim from Point Nepean to Point Lonsdale, and since 2014, more than 1,000 people have done it. Apparently, survival counts as a participation trophy. But don't get it twisted. These swimmers don't just show up to take a dip in the Rip. These swims are tightly choreographed, and they're kinda picky about who gets to do it. To qualify, you need to swim 1.8 miles, 3 kilometers in under 54 minutes. Out here, though, the course runs take longer, and the average finisher takes about 70 minutes. Boats follow the swimmers, ready to provide medical help. Doctors and paramedics are on standby, too. No mention of priests for last rites. Swimmers have to follow the organizer's instructions to the letter. Makes sense. They went to the trouble of clearing the Rip of cargo ships. Nothing ruins a PB like getting T-boned by a container vessel. Now you can see why it took 136 years for anyone to actually swim the Rip. The first madman was Doug Mew in 1971. Only 70 others followed before the modern event came along. Basically, people looked at this stretch of water for over 100 years and said, "Yeah, nah, I like being alive." The fact it takes military-level coordination just to swim 2 miles, 3.2 kilometers, tells you everything. And it's not just the ships and reefs that cause problems, though those are pretty bad. The real killer is the tides. The tides in the Rip can move up to 6.8 miles an hour, 11 kilometers an hour. That's thanks to the powerful currents tearing through this narrow gap. And they've caused more than shipwrecks. These waters are also the stage for one of Australia's least known military disasters. February 17, 1960. 74 commandos from Australia's 2nd Commando Company left from Point Lonsdale. The mission? Raid the Port Sea Officer School. Yeah, it was a training exercise, but it was about to get deadly serious. Soon after setting out, the commandos were swept straight through the rip by a powerful tide. Then came the 33-foot, 10-meter waves. They slammed into their kayaks and amphibious craft. One by one, they capsized. Warrant Officer George Drakopoulos and Private Eddie Meyer drowned. The survivors were calling for help. Soon, the rescue boats came, but the tragedy was far from over. It was about to get worse. The strong tides overturned even these boats. An Italian ship, the Toscana, arrived to help. Commando Roger Wood hauled his teammates aboard. But even a sturdier ship can have trouble in these waters. The currents tore him from the rope ladder. He vanished beneath the waves, and his body was never recovered. Proof that when the ocean wants to win, it doesn't need much help. And the rip's dangerous conditions still don't end there. Zoom out to look at the rip on a map again. Imagine you're sailing north toward the port of Melbourne. That'll make the obstacles clear. Approaching the rip from Bass Strait, the water starts out at about 98 feet deep, 30 meters. But just 2,600 feet, about 800 meters south of Nepean and Lonsdale, you hit the rip bank. Inside the heads, the floor drops again, plunging to 328 feet, 100 meters. But it can get shallow too, barely 16 feet, 5 meters at spots. Good luck guessing which one you'll get. That's why hundreds of people have lost their lives in this treacherous place, and just part of why it's an engineering nightmare. How do you even set bridge piers here when the tides and sandbars are constantly rearranging the seafloor? It's like trying to build on quicksand, only wetter, deeper, and actively trying to kill you. A bridge over the rip wouldn't be a simple one either. It would need to be high enough to avoid the constant flow of ships below. Here's bridge math, simplified. Don't let a ship hit it. Easy to say, hard to engineer. Ships are supposed to clear the bridge by at least 6.5 feet, 2 meters on top, and 16 feet, 5 meters on the sides. On paper, that works. In practice, nobody wants to be the captain who tests those measurements. So engineers build higher, wider, and safer because barely fits is not the kind of review you want for your bridge. Take the proposed I-10 bridge in Mobile, Alabama in the US. It's supposed to be 215 feet, 65 and a half meters tall just to clear modern cruise ships. Floating skyscrapers a whopping 200 feet, 60 meters above the waterline. Effectively, a 20-story condo on vacation. The cargo ships docking in Melbourne don't usually reach those heights. But that doesn't mean a bridge over the rip would get a free pass. At least 11 cruise ships from 7 different cruise lines visit the port of Melbourne every year. And cruise ships don't exactly duck. If a bridge is in the way, the bridge loses. So a bridge over the rip would need to be about the same height as the I-10 bridge in Alabama. The difference? The I-10 isn't being built over an angry waterway. Mobile just has to worry about traffic jams. Melbourne would have to worry about the ocean trying to kill it. Tall bridges need tall, sturdy piers built from top-grade material. They're holding up more than just the deck and suspension cables. They have to play bodyguard to thousands of tons of steel. They have to survive everything the environment throws at them. On higher, longer bridges, the piers are built as rigid columns, basically solid blocks. That way, they can resist bending, shear forces, and axial forces. They're designed to stay there and say, "Come at me," to nature. A bridge over the rip wouldn't just be stressed from the top load, but from all directions. The strong currents would hammer the bridge. The rip's basically a full-time gym trainer for concrete. There's no rest days. And that's not all. There's something else odd about the Melbourne area. If you live there, especially in the coastal suburbs, strengthen your windows and doors. Park your car in a garage and keep it away from tall trees at all costs. Oh, and have an emergency generator. It sounds a bit like the hurricane-prone US East and Gulf Coast, but Melbourne isn't that extreme. The worst wind on record hit on September 3, 1982. 74.5 miles an hour, 120 kilometers an hour. Technically, that's Category 1 hurricane strength. A cold front ripped through, leaving blackouts, torn off roofs, uprooted trees, and chaos. It was a sample-size hurricane, and it still made a mess of Melbourne. This event might have been a rarity, but gusty conditions are common in Melbourne. Strong southerly winds of about 50 miles an hour, 80 kilometers an hour, are common. To find out why, let's zoom further out. Look at a map of the whole world. And there's Melbourne, 37 degrees south latitude. Things can get pretty hectic down here. That's because of a few lopsided world stats. Australia might be its own continent, but it's not as big as you think. It's the world's smallest continent, 3 million square miles, 7.7 million square kilometers. That's actually smaller than Antarctica, smaller than Europe. It's about the same size as the contiguous United States. Sure, the contiguous US is a big place, but not when it comes to the Northern Hemisphere. That gives us a clue. Slice the world in half at the equator, and only two continents sit entirely in the southern hemisphere, Australia and Antarctica. Everywhere else leans north. The map shows it. 68% of the world's land is in the north, just 32% in the south. Up north, it's a 60-40 water-to-land mix. Down south, it's 80-20. Basically, the southern hemisphere is Earth's watery basement apartment. Less land to slow things down means nastier winds and currents. Warm tropical air drifts south, rides up over polar cold fronts, and then Earth's rotation gives it an extra shove. It's nature's wind tunnel without an off switch. Look back at Melbourne again. It's barely north of a place that sailors call the Roaring Forties. These strong westerly winds produce frequent gale force conditions. They squeeze towards southern Australia because of a subtropical ridge of high pressure. That shoves winds either poleward or back towards the equator. That ridge usually sits just north of Melbourne, around 30 degrees south. High pressure usually means calm weather, but not for Melbourne. Remember that cold front, the one that created the highest wind speed recorded in the area? It started in the Southern Ocean, then charged north and slammed into the subtropical ridge. The result? Air moving fast enough to remind everyone that high pressure doesn't always mean toasty. And even the Antarctic cold fronts have FOMO. The further south you go in the world, the more extreme the winds and currents get. Beyond the Roaring Forties are the Furious Fifties and the Screaming Sixties. Really imaginative names, yeah? Anyway, together, they shove cold air north toward the equator at full blast. These are the winds that a bridge over the rip would have to deal with all the time. But Australia has another trick that makes Melbourne's weather a nightmare for engineers. You can probably guess this one. The land down under can get really hot. And Melbourne is no exception. The mercury peaked at 116 degrees Fahrenheit, 47 Celsius, on February 7th, 2009. To put that into context, that's 10 degrees Fahrenheit, 6 degrees Celsius more than the highest temperature ever recorded in New York City. Luckily, Melbourne isn't constantly reaching for the sunblock. January is its warmest month, averaging a pretty mild 68 Fahrenheit, 20 Celsius. That's because of an oceanic climate and steady sea breezes. Those southern winds don't bring chaos, they just show up as free air conditioning. Further north, different story. The Australian outback is a very hot desert. Daytime temperatures over 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 Celsius. They can hit over 110 Fahrenheit, 45 Celsius. It's so hot here that towns like Coober Pedy went full mole people. They built underground because air conditioning only does so much. Hold on though, Melbourne's nowhere near the outback, right? Yeah, that's right, but this is Australia. Nothing is simple. The heat up north has an effect here too. By day, Australia's hot landmass drags in cooler sea air. By night, it's Batman. Wait, sorry, wrong video. At night, the flow flips. The back and forth keeps Melbourne nice and breezy. So now you have it. Melbourne is pretty much a wind tunnel. Great for windsurfers, not so much for engineers and suspension bridges. Don't believe me? History's got my back. On July 1st, 1940, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge opened across the Puget Sound in Washington State in the US, nearly 6,000 feet, 1,800 meters long, and built with extra flexibility. The problem? The engineers forgot to factor in the wind. 4 months later, the wind sent them the bill, and it wasn't cheap. On November 7th, 40-mile-an-hour, 64-kilometer-an-hour winds hit the area. Okay, it's hardly hurricane force, but it was enough. Concrete started to fall from the road surface. A few minutes later, a 600-foot, 183-meter section of the bridge went bye-bye. The structure began to toss and turn like a bucking bronco. One side of the bridge rose 28 feet, 8.5 meters above the other side. Now, I'm no bridge expert, but that's probably not a good thing. Steel towers versus the elements. Place your bets. The engineers hadn't designed for aerodynamic forces. When strong winds hit the bridge from just the wrong direction, it began to oscillate. And just like me, on the dance floor, the rhythm was too much. The structure broke. Dive to the bottom of Puget Sound and you'll find a massive reef. But it's not natural. It's built on the carcass of the original Tacoma Narrows Bridge. The site's even on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. The government officially protects a shipwrecked bridge from being salvaged. It's a cautionary tale. You don't need extreme winds to tear a massive bridge apart. Sometimes one small oversight is all it takes, which is why Melbourne's windy conditions aren't just an inconvenience, they're a demand. Engineers have no choice but to pay attention. And it's not just the sea and the wind. Think back to March 26th, 2024. Even if the date doesn't ring a bell, the event will. It's another reminder of what engineers in Melbourne would be forced to deal with. In the dead of night, the container ship MV Dolly decided to get a closer look at the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. Well, it slammed right into it. The entire bridge collapsed. 6 members of a maintenance crew were killed right there. But that was just the beginning. Shipping in and out of the port of Baltimore was choked off until June. 8,000 jobs were hit. The economy bled $15 million a day for 11 weeks. Maryland now has plans to rebuild the bridge by fall of 2028. The price tag? Up to $1.9 billion. That's a lot of money for a do-over. There would be only one way to stop tragedies like these from happening to a bridge over the rip. The foundation for the piers would need to be deep. Bridge piers offer a simple rule of thumb. 1 inch, 2.5 centimeters of thickness for every foot of span. So a 20-foot, 6-meter foundation means piers at least 20 inches, 51 centimeters wide. In other words, the math is easy. The hard part is everything else. A bridge here should probably expect to be struck by ships every now and then. With rough currents, strong winds, and barely any room to maneuver, bridge piers here would be sitting in a shooting gallery. We might not live in the age of sail anymore, but the wind doesn't know that. Just ask the Ever Given. In 2021, it hit a dust storm in the Suez Canal. It lost steering and wedged itself sideways. 6 days stuck, $400 million lost every hour. All because of one gust. But the winds in Melbourne are fierce too, remember? The stress on the bridge and the dangers to the ships will be BFFs. That's why early studies of a potential bridge warned the piers could disrupt shipping into the bay. Nothing like solving one problem by creating another, yeah? That means digging deeper foundations or building barriers to keep ships from slamming into them. And the bigger the ships, the more you'll need those barriers. Since Melbourne hosts its fair share of modern cruise liners, any bridge here would need serious defenses, stronger foundations, tougher barriers, and a design ready to take on the currents and wind. And that's where the problem really begins. Building the foundations would be a nightmare. Constant currents and shifting sands make setting bridge piers or even tunneling a gamble. The soil here is soft and unstable. It's the last place you'd want to park heavy infrastructure. But despite all of this, some people have thought about it. It's easy to see why. One candidate running for local office in 2009 had a major complaint. 200 billion Australian dollars worth of infrastructure sat on either side of Port Phillip Bay. And there was no bridge. Just like my academic career, it was wasted potential. There's been more than one proposal for a bridge, despite all the challenges. The earliest goes back to the 1950s. But there was a more serious idea in March 1998. Local engineer David Broadbent studied 10 possible bridge routes across the rip. His verdict? Let's just say he wasn't a glass-half-full type of guy. Remember when I said that the bridge probably wouldn't be as short as the 2-mile, 3.2-kilometer gap between the peninsulas? Broadbent ruled out the obvious shortcut between Point Lonsdale and Point Nepean. Nepean's too unstable for any bridge or tunnel. That meant stretching things much farther. In the end, the design would need a 3.1-mile, 5-kilometer reach. It would have a main span of 1.5 miles, 2.5 kilometers. In other words, Melbourne's missing bridge would be like my McDonald's order, supersized. That would make the Rip Bridge the longest suspension bridge in the world, easily. The current record holder is the 1915 Çanakkale Bridge in Turkey that crosses Dardanelles. It's 1.2 miles, 2 kilometers long. And the challenges don't just stop at engineering. Actually, engineering might even be the easier part. Dr. David Wilson, senior transport safety investigator at the Australia Transport Safety Board, even said it was technologically a piece of cake. So, what's the problem? Back in 2009, the bridge's loudest political booster, Peter Brohier, even brought a price tag with him to the campaign trail. Nothing wins votes like promising billions in concrete. He said that the Rip Bridge would cost about 9 billion Australian dollars. That's 7 billion in Freedom Bucks. 3.1 billion for major construction, another 3.9 billion for ancillary works. How much money is that? That's a lot for a bridge. The 1915 Çanakkale Bridge cost about $2.7 billion to build. That would be about $1.8 billion in 2009. So a Rip Bridge could cost about four times as much, and that's just what it would take to actually construct it. The costs would go beyond that, way beyond. Dr. Wilson argued the bridge made no sense on a cost-benefit basis, probably not for another 50 years of population growth. And he wasn't just talking about money. In 2009, the Victorian Transport Plan had a budget of 38 billion Australian dollars. If locals really wanted a bridge, they could have built one. But wanted is the key word. And clearly, they didn't. At last, we've come to the real boss fight. Tolls, views, currents, whales, and two small towns that don't want a megastructure on their doorstep. The challenge, navigate the NIMBYs, aka not in my backyards. They're the gatekeepers of almost every big project on Earth. In their world, infrastructure is great as long as it happens somewhere else. A bridge over the Rip? Sure, as long as it's invisible from the balcony. And if you think local politics is tough, try telling someone with a million-dollar bay view that it's about to be framed by concrete and toll booths. Good luck with that campaign slogan. Nothing screams progress like a decade in court. Look at a map of Melbourne's population density. The vast majority of people live on the northern rim of the bay. For now. That doesn't mean there's no one around on the peninsulas across the Rip. The towns of Queenscliff and Sorrento are a lot closer to where the action is. Queenscliff had a population of almost 3,300 in the 2021 census. Sorrento's was around 2,000. They're scenic suburbs with million-dollar views of the bay. A bridge would do a lot more than just ruin these nice vistas. The bridge would need to be built further inland. That puts the small towns in the crosshairs. Construction would be far more intrusive for residents. Translation? The budget starts climbing before the first concrete is even poured. And the hard sells keep coming. You need to make that money back. Authorities would start eyeing that 200 billion Australian dollar infrastructure pie, which has only grown since 2009. And no, you wouldn't be crossing the Rip Bridge for free. A toll would be inevitable. And with tolls comes the usual chorus of opposition. Also, who would be doing the crossing? Who would really benefit the most? Not the people going about their business in Melbourne. It'd be tourists leaving the city to look at the countryside. The bridge would mainly carry people who don't live there. Maybe it would bring in additional tourism revenue to the Melbourne Metro. But bulldozing parts of Queenscliff and Sorrento, slapping on tolls, it's not exactly a winning pitch in local politics. And then there are the environmental impacts. When Peter Brohier pitched his Rip Bridge, one local environmental campaigner dismissed it as about as likely as a fox flying across the heads. And she had a point. Beyond the shipping problems, a long bridge with sprawling piers would also pack a serious environmental punch. On July 24th of this year, Melbourne got an unusual show under the Westgate Bridge, two humpback whales playing in the Yarra. It was the first sighting that far in over a decade. Port Phillip Bay hosts plenty of marine visitors. Humpbacks, southern rights, dolphins, even orcas drawn by the seals. Whale numbers are on the rise too. In 2016, a record 103 were spotted near Melbourne. Whale watching is big business, and dolphins often join the fun, except when orcas show up. They're less into playdates, more into bite-sized snacks. So impact on the whales would need to be added to the environmental impact study. That'll cost more. So for now, there's no bridge. But there's another, more attractive way to get across the two peninsulas. There's a ferry service between Queenscliff and Sorrento. The ferries started the way most good businesses do, with risky ideas. In the 1980s, navigators Paul Ring, Keith Finnemore, and Maury Cobal looked at Melbourne's lack of a bay crossing and thought, it needs a boat. In 1983, they launched Peninsula Sea Road Transport. Say you're in the center of Melbourne, and you need to get to Point Nepean. Your road trip would take an hour and a half. Taking a taxi is too expensive, $160 Australian. A bus ride might take 5 hours. And that's just halfway around the bay. The ferry guys knew how much of a headache it was to get between Points Lonsdale and Nepean by land. You'd have to drive all the way around the bay. It's a bit like trying to get from Greece to Turkey without crossing the Dardanelles or Bosporus. Sure, there is a way, but it's the scenic route around the entire Black Sea. Understandably, the Victorian authorities were excited. Who doesn't love ferries and money? On September 19th, 1987, the Peninsula Princess started to take passengers. It wasn't smooth sailing, though. This place is called the Rip, remember? Just a few weeks into its service life, the Peninsula Princess got caught up in those roaring 40s winds. The boat rocked in the shallows and got a broken propeller for its troubles. So business had to stop for a while. It looked like the critics might have been right, because not everyone loved the idea of the ferry. The opponents even thought it was stupid. They said the novelty would wear off pretty quickly. Well, they were wrong. The repairs to the Peninsula Princess were made and business took off. It did so well that two more ships were added, the MV Queenscliff in 1993 and the MV Sorrento in 2001. Sea Road ferries proved everyone wrong, though geography was always on its side. The boats cut the trip between the two peninsulas from hours to about 40 minutes. Today, the Queenscliff and Sorrento haul more than 110,000 vehicles a year across the Rip. And let's be honest, it's more fun than crawling over some suspension bridge. Sea Road Ferries is now a Melbourne institution, and they're more than just floating parking lots taking cars across the bay. They look like miniature cruise ships. The ferries have passenger lounges with views of Port Phillip Bay. There are spaces for kids, seniors, even couples, plus a restaurant. Passengers have even snapped dolphins surfacing from the Bass Strait. The ferries offer something a suspension bridge never could: dinner and a show. And the ferries aren't just stopping with where they are now. The company is making new investments to stay ahead of the game. One of them? New terminals. Right now, Sea Road Ferries is building what it calls a state-of-the-art terminal at its Sorrento Landing. The upgrades include a modernized waiting area with new food and drink kiosks. More importantly, there's better infrastructure for loading and unloading cars. They've already completed a brand new terminal for its Queenscliff landing. It opened in April of 2023, and it won awards in just 2 years. That would be the Architectural Master Prize, an international architecture award created to honor excellence. And here's me still waiting for YouTube to give me that diamond play button. You know what to do. Subscribe. Sea Road Ferries has turned the Rip into something convenient, even enjoyable. But don't forget, there's still a business. A bridge would be direct competition, and the public's already on their side. After all, why trade in a scenic ferry ride for an expensive, ugly slab of concrete? But the ferries are far from perfect. For all the modernization of the terminals, the ships still have a big problem they'll never be able to solve. The Rip is, well, the Rip. The Rip gave the Peninsula Princess a rough welcome on her first trip, and the waters haven't mellowed since. That's why the ferries themselves can't change much. Bigger or faster ships aren't an option. The seas are simply too rough. Researchers at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology studied the problem and came to the same conclusion. The Rip sets the rules. So the Nimbys and their ferries might not be able to hold off the bridge forever. Especially now. Melbourne's population is growing. Sometime by 2031 to 32, it's expected to move past Sydney as the most populated metro area in Australia. The population will increase to over 6 million people. Melbourne's central business district is already Australia's most densely packed urban area, with 19,000 residents per square kilometer in 2018. But the sprawl doesn't end there. Carlton, South Yarra, Fitzroy, and Collingwood round out Victoria's top five most densely packed suburbs. The winds haven't kept people away. Australians are moving there for better job prospects and a lower cost of living. It's also been a hub for international migration, thanks to the encouragement of the Victorian state governments. Most of the new arrivals are young. The city has more births than deaths. So public infrastructure will need to keep up. And that will include more of the outlying areas. It's a simple case of supply and demand. As more people squeeze into Melbourne's center, housing prices climb. That pushes newcomers towards suburbs closer to the Rip. And with them comes demand for better connections. And that could mean more Sea Road ferries. But there's a little matter of price to cross the channel. Did you think all those fun things on the boat or in the terminal came for free? As of March 2025, a one-way ticket cost $49. It sounds expensive, but zoom out a little more and you can put that price into context. A ferry from the mainland to Tasmania costs $115. The Spirit of Tasmania sails 258 miles, 415 kilometers from Geelong to Devonport. That works out to about $3.60 per kilometer. Crossing the Rip? Try $15 per kilometer. So no matter what it costs to build, a bridge toll wouldn't touch that price. At least, not for a long while. And speaking of time, 40 minutes might not be fast enough, especially if the population in the suburbs keeps growing. Travel times over a suspension bridge would be a lot shorter. The journey would typically be just 2 minutes and 30 seconds. You might think all that increased road traffic would lead to more pollution. You'd actually be wrong. The bridge would actually do the opposite. Researchers said the current road situation wasn't environmentally sustainable. More people coming to the Melbourne metro area will make that worse. New vehicles would mean increased demand on the local roads and on the ferries. A bridge over the Rip would save a lot of travel time. In 2023, Mornington Peninsula's former mayor, Steve Holland, tossed his hat into the Rip Bridge ring. Sort of. He sketched a diagram on a napkin and slapped on a nice round price tag, $20 billion. The idea at least got people talking. On the other side of the Rip, former Mayor Isabel Tolhurst made it clear her jurisdiction wasn't buying into the costly project. She softened her stance after that, but the message was clear. Thanks, but no thanks. As Melbourne grows, new arrivals may start making demands the old locals won't like. For now, though, you can still swim the Rip under supervision and not worry about dodging bridge piers on the way across. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed the video, and if you want to see more videos like this, then please consider subscribing and turn on notifications. It really does make a difference. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time on MatPack.